This vintage Dreamland is not up to our usual audio quality. However, the content is extremely interesting. Please note that none of the 800 numbers mentioned in this are now working numbers, none at all. So please do not call them and do not attempt to get through to the show or to buy anything via the 800 numbers listed in this show. This is a very old program from the year 2000, and it has no longer got any valid advertising in it. Also, the call-in numbers mentioned later in the show are dead as well.
This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We have with us now William Henry, the author of One Foot in Atlantis, The Secret Occult History of World War II. I have been fascinated by this book for a long time. I wanted to put this book in the Whitley Strieber's Hidden Agendas series being published by Dell Books. And to my chagrin and chilled amazement, after we had edited it, after I had written an introduction, we were all finished and ready to publish it, suddenly the editor at Dell said no. And I found it chilling. This is supposed to be my Hidden Agenda series, and suddenly I'm being censored. There's no other word for it, because I don't think his reasons were really very strong. So we have William Henry, the author of One Foot in Atlantis, on with us, and this is not unlike Ship of the Damned. This is not a book you're going to be finding in too many stores. You can get it by clicking through from whitleysworld.com and buy it online right now if you want to. Or during business hours, you can call our 800 number, 1-800-898-0284, and get it that way. That's 1-800-898-0284. Well, William Henry, it's really good to have you with us.
Well, great to talk to you too, Whitley. Thank you for having me on the program.
Yeah.
And thank you for your effort on behalf of Bantam Dell. I'm sorry that didn't work out.
Well, it's a really disturbing thing because I expected to be the one who made the editorial decisions pretty much here. And I think that we are looking at a very, very sensitive hidden agenda. Let me just start off with the first paragraph of this thing. Suddenly, a startling fact leaped from the page you wrote. In 1934, at the height of the Great Depression, President Franklin D. Roosevelt and his Secretary of Agriculture, Henry Wallace, who was much more, incidentally, folks, than just a Secretary of Agriculture, sent agents to Central Asia. He was one of Roosevelt's closest friends. They claimed they were seeking drought-resistant grasses. However, as reported in Newsweek magazine, in the Roosevelt administration, it was common knowledge that FDR and Wallace were actually looking for the reincarnated Jesus in Shambhala, the Buddhist paradise. You wrote those words, and that is the beginning of one of the most extraordinary stories I've read in a long, long time. Let's get going.
Thank you. That is an absolutely true story. Startling beyond imagination in its implications. I mean, just think, we have a sitting president and a man whom FDR hand-selected as his successor, his potential successor. He wanted Henry Wallace to be president in the worst way. But the Democratic high command said, what are you doing? How could you possibly conceive of putting this hayseed hick in the White House? But as a matter of fact, FDR had a very good reason for selecting Henry Wallace as his running mate in 1940 as his vice presidential candidate, and that was because they had been looking for the Holy Grail and the reincarnated Jesus since 1934. They were enacting the archetypal role of the three wise men. They were in cahoots with a Russian mystic guru and painter by the name of Nicholas Roerich, and the three of them together conspired to pull the trigger on the so-called second coming of a Christ or Messiah.
When you say pull the trigger, what do you mean?
They were, in enacting the archetypal drama of the three wise men, they were going forward with the fulfillment of the prophecy of the second coming. They were, I believe, acting on some of the prophecies of Nostradamus as well as prophecies in the book of Revelation and also some of the apocryphal texts which Nicholas Rorich had claimed to have recovered in India.
So when you say they were attempting to induce the second coming?
That's right. They sent Nicholas Rorich to Mongolia not only to search for signs of the second coming, but because they knew that this was not an event that was just going to happen, contrary to public, or rather the mainstream sort of Christian belief. They knew that this had to be a handshake between man and God. And so when he was over there, they were actually fulfilling the blueprint that would enable this event to occur.
You know, I'm listening very closely to what you say because I think that you're a person in possession of a lot of secret knowledge, and I want to know exactly why you used the word handshake just then.
Well, part of the reason is because it literally is the ancient alchemical law, the Egyptian law attributed to Thoth, as above, so below. There has to be a unity of heaven and earth in the tradition of which FDR and Nicholas Rorich and Henry Wallace subscribe, a theosophical tradition. They believed that peace was not the absence of conflict between jealous religions on earth or warring factions on earth. They believed that peace was the unity of heaven and earth. And there were definite steps, there were definite technologies, definite spiritual teachings that had to be recovered in order to create that link, that bond.
So they must have thought of themselves as being in a race with time, given what was going on in Europe in 1934, with Hitler having just become chancellor.
Most definitely. And I also have a feeling, too, Whitley, that they knew that while their actions in 1934 were tremendously important, the actual second shoe would not fall till perhaps the time of the millennium. So they were working on a very long time frame, but they did have to beat Hitler and the Nazis to the punch, to the recovery of the Grail technology, the Grail secrets, for example.
Why was that?
Well, because Hitler was over there operating off the same premise. What you had was a sort of a Christ-type scenario and an Antichrist-type scenario over there in Nazi Germany. You had a literal madman who conceived of himself as the Nordic Christ or Messiah who was going to introduce a thousand-year Reich, which is the inverse version of the Book of Revelation, which calls for a thousand years of peace after the arrival of a Christ Messiah or Earth Teacher.
I guess that must be why he chose the number 1,000 years, isn't it?
That's precisely why he chose that. He was using the Book of Revelation as sort of a cookbook for the way he could manipulate the mind of the German people, who were very deeply religious people.
Yes, and he transformed them into something very different from what they thought of themselves, that's for sure. Who exactly, let's talk about Rorich a little bit. Who exactly was this man?
Nicholas Rorich was a Russian mystic. His family traced its roots to the deepest antiquity of Russia. They were Viking people. He was raised as a wealthy prince and trained as an archaeologist and painter, who literally believed that he had a world mission and set out to fulfill it in conjunction with FDR and Henry Wallace.
Okay, that music means that we are down at the bottom of the hour, and we are going to be talking to William Henry about this extraordinary occult conflict that developed between FDR and Hitler in the 30s as they both went on a desperate search for the hidden meaning of the Holy Grail. This is Whitley Strieber, it's Dreamland, and we'll be back.
Streamer on the Premier Radio Networks. And now, here's Whitley.
This is Dreamland, and we're back. We'll be talking to William Henry again in just a minute. Next week, Will Thomas and Greg Avery, the latest on the chemtrail controversy. There have been some breakthroughs. There have been some leaks. Both of these chemtrail experts have got explosive new information to talk about. Dovetailing with this, Dr. Michael Osterholm, author of Living Terrors, What America Needs to Know to Survive the Coming Bioterrorist Catastrophe. There will be a Whitley's World News special about this upcoming program during the course of the week. Do not miss it. Sign up on ListBot on whitleysworld.com. Also, there's going to be, and I'm going to be mentioning this from time to time, it's available, you'll find the information about it on the website. There's going to be a Christmas special on CellGuard, a very nice special, a box of 10 CellGuards for $175, that includes shipping and handling. That's an effective price of $17.50 per CellGuard, and I think they make wonderful and helpful Christmas presents. So bear that in mind. A box of 10 for $175, that would be, the regular price for that box would be $250. Okay, well, William Henry's website is journeysbeyond.com. That's journeysbeyond.com. I have another piece of information. KRSX in Arizona, in central Arizona, is running a poll. If you want Dreamland to stay on the air and you listen to KRSX, you should write KRSX at theriver.com. That's KRSX at theriver.com and say, yes, I listen on KRSX and I would very much like to see the show continue, and Coast to Coast 2 for that matter. Okay, in just a couple of minutes, we will be returning to the occult history of World War II with William Henry. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland, and we'll be back. It's Dreamland. I made a slight mistake a moment ago. I misread my script, and William Henry's website is www.williamhenry.net. That's WILLIAMHENRY.net. The journeysbeyond.com website is for a conference that William Henry is going to be appearing at in Fort Walton Beach, Florida, October 10th through the 22nd. This is October 20th through the 22nd. This is a conference that I went to for many years. It used to be in Gulf Breeze, and now it's just down the beach a little ways in Fort Walton Beach. Always a lovely conference. Always a very enjoyable group of people. Not too big, not too small. Lots of fun. And William Henry is going to be there. Learn more about it at journeysbeyond.com. Okay, William, let's get back to the business at hand. We were talking about Rurik. How did he become involved with Wallace and Eisenhower?
With Wallace and FDR?
FDR. What am I saying? I'm sorry.
What happened, there was a Russian botanist by the name of Borodine that suddenly appeared in Henry Wallace's cornfield in 1929. And they got to talking, and Wallace had been deeply on a very profound spiritual search ever since he was a young man. He grew up under the tutelage of George Washington Carver, who is a veritable shaman, and literally taught Henry, young Henry, to peer behind the window of nature. At least that's what Henry said, that Carver took him under his wing and taught him how to talk to the plants, the secrets of the soil. And when this Russian botanist Borodine appeared and said, hey, you know, there's a guy up in Russia that really talks your language, the language of the birds, the language of nature. You two ought to hook up. And so Henry started communicating with Rurik as soon as Rurik moved to New York City in 1929. He read Rurik's books, and letters were exchanged. It was about that same time that FDR was introduced to Rurik by FDR's mother. And so the three of them started their dance in the late 1920s, and it didn't take long before they realized that the three of them together had a profound spiritual destiny.
Was FDR's involvement in the Masons in any way connected with this?
Oh, without question. However, FDR is more than just a Mason, as my research unfolds. He had been intimately involved with the Oak Island mystery, for example, since his early 20s.
Let's just stop and explain what that is. I think most of our listeners probably know, but there are going to be some of us who are thinking, wait a minute, what was that, the Oak Island mystery?
Mm-hmm. Oak Island is a treasure vault that is located in Oak Island, Nova Scotia. FDR grew up spending his summers at Campobello Island off the coast of Maine, which is just a half a day's boat ride from Oak Island. And he heard the stories growing up of the treasure of Captain William Kidd, of billions of dollars of Templar gold, Knights Templar gold, and the secrets of the Templar that had been stored there. Knights Templar, of course, are the Knights of Christ who had removed the secrets of Jesus, possibly even the Ark of the Covenant, maybe even alchemical secrets from King Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem, moved them to Scotland, where they were then later transported across the Atlantic and deposited there at Oak Island. And so as a young man, FDR learns the lore of the Templars, who are somewhat akin to the Masons in some people's view, learns the lore of the treasure that's hidden there. And when he has an opportunity in his 20s as a young lawyer, he buys shares in a mining company that's attempting to recover that treasure. He actually is writing about Oak Island up until his second term as president. I've actually got the letters that he was exchanging with people that were involved in the Oak Island treasure hunt. And he actually also used the Oak Island story as a filibuster as president. Henry Wallace tells the story of his very first meeting with FDR as Secretary of Agriculture, when FDR sits down with a guy that he didn't want to particularly talk to, so he goes on for an hour and a half all about the Oak Island mystery sitting there in the Oval Office. I mean, he can only imagine what kind of conversation that had to have been, where FDR's going into deep detail about what's happening there at the Knights Templar treasure vault.
That's just fascinating because, of course, inside the inner reaches of Masonry, there is a lot of material connecting the Masonic movement at its highest levels with the Templars. And in fact, that the Templars, that the Masons are an outgrowth of the Templars. But let's return now to the Russian connection, because this is a kind of a wild card. And you have to wonder why that man ended up in Henry Wallace's cornfield and exactly what he was doing and who he was seeking to influence. Did Wallace know Roosevelt at that time?
No, he did not. Wallace was still just basically hanging out in Iowa, uncertain about what he was going to do in his future. He had already come up with the first version of hybrid corn for commercial use, and he was just kind of wandering around his field of dreams out there. And the bottom line explanation for why I feel the three of them got together coagulates around a very strange word, and that word is Rus. You find it in the name Roosevelt. You find it in the name Charles Rus, who was another of Henry A. Wallace's shamanic mentors. You also find it in the original family name of Nicholas Rorick's, Rus. And Rus is a word
that... He's a Russian, too.
Rus is Russia, exactly. And that's all. That goes back to Egypt. The Uraeus serpent that you see projecting from the forehead of Pharaohs.
Yes.
It's called the Rus. And what that is it's representative of a spiritual technology that enables one to peer behind the window of nature and manipulate matter. And I feel that Rus connection, it's a very strange spiritual force that brought these three together. Franklin Roosevelt, Nicholas Rurik and his Rus connection, and then Henry Wallace with his training by Charles Rus. Very strange set of circumstances, but I feel that explains it.
One of the most fascinating things about One Foot in Atlantis is the way you work with words like this, that you're not afraid to make these tenuous connections that actually are revelatory of the truth. It's interesting that right now we're talking about something that is profoundly connected with one of the deepest occult mysteries in Western thought, and that is blood. And a little while ago, earlier in the program, I don't know if you heard it or not, we were talking about a breakthrough connected with cattle mutilations that had to do with some extraordinary scientific findings about the way the blood of the animals has been treated. We were at that moment, at that time in the show, kind of talking about a higher science. And in your effort to kind of take a new look at history through the hidden meaning of words, there is another kind of a higher level of consciousness being talked about here, almost as if this connection, which I think is in some way a real connection, has to do with a hidden history, a history that we don't actually know about and can't really discuss, except you have been able to.
Yeah.
So go on about it.
What I try to do is kickstart the Grail engine, the Grail consciousness. Christ is a consciousness. The Grail is a consciousness. It was put there by the Egyptian god of magic Thoth, who projected 36,525 books containing all the sacred knowledge of the universe into what he describes as a thought sphere that encapsulates our planet. And he left a language code by which anyone can access that. The Druid people, the people of Rus called it the language of the bards, the language of the birds. It's a poetic language. It's a phonetic Kabbalah. And by apprehending these language keys, by putting together the seemingly unconnected words, we're able to plug our brains into this collective Grail consciousness.
And Rorik, of course, was familiar with the birds and the songs of the birds.
Oh, he left a beautiful painting called The Language of the Birds. And King Solomon was the one that spoke this language. This is the Templar connection with it as well, because the Bible says that God gave Solomon all his wealth and wisdom, Shazam, like that, as if he was struck by a beam of light. The Quran is much more specific. It says that in Surah 126 that Solomon learned the language of the bards. This gave him his immense wealth and wisdom. This language is something that all of us can learn. Or so said Heinrich Himmler, who spent immense, immense amounts of time attempting to relearn this language because they believed that it was the original pre-flood language and that this language was also the language code of the original Atlantean super science. And by apprehending this language, not only could we transmute the elements, we could turn ourselves into higher godlike beings, which is the purpose of earthly existence, according to the mystery schools.
You know, you're as interesting to listen to as you are to read, I'm glad to say. Your book, I mean, this really reflects what makes this book so remarkable. I mean, here is somebody who has kind of cracked a code, and we are beginning to hear over the radio things that I have always thought were confined to the inner halls of very secret societies. Let's talk a little bit now. You mentioned Heinrich Himmler about the Nazi connection to this, because it was as if one light and one dark force rose up in the life of the world, and they clashed in an incredible drama, which was an attempt to wrest or to gain this power. And talk a little bit about the Himmler connection, if you will.
Yeah, Heinrich Himmler was the number two Nazi. He's the guy with the kind of the pink face, the little round head, and the glasses.
Right, the man who was most personally responsible for the Holocaust.
Right.
Ahead of the SS.
Yeah, I like to say he put the SS in Hitler's messianic delusion. Hitler was, I think if truth be told, probably the puppet on Himmler's string. And it was Himmler that was deeply, deeply interested in the occult secrets of the ancients. He had an incredible, incredible library at his castle at Wewelsburg, deep in the heart of Germany, that contained, the estimates run between 12,000 and 20,000 volumes of occult history. They made a massive research of Europe and, in fact, the world attempting to piece together the original language system of the ancients. And again, as I mentioned a moment ago, I mean, there's a story that illustrates this. Heinrich Himmler looked at the Japanese ideograms and said, hey, wait a minute, those are strikingly similar to our Nordic ideograms. And lo and behold, he said, well, you know, the Japanese people, you must be Nordic Japanese. And in fact, in Japanese legend and lore, they say that they were created by a blonde race that came from the stars and promised to return. And it was Himmler's desire to beat FDR, beat the Allies, to those secrets. Another druid that's involved in this whole story, I might add, was Winston Churchill. I mean, we've actually got pictures of Winston Churchill at his induction ceremony at the Order of Albion, which was a Holy Grail order of the druids.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's absolutely amazing. I've read his whole 7-volume history of World War II, and he doesn't mention this at all.
Oh, no, you can go to Stuart Pigott's book about the druids, and you can actually see the photograph. And, of course, historians say, well, Churchill was doing that for entertainment purposes only. Well, I don't buy that. One of the reasons is because that V for victory symbol that Churchill walked around using, that's a druid symbol. It's also a mother goddess symbol that goes back at least 6,000 years, and what it symbolizes is the language of the birds.
And
indicating that Churchill is kind of like an up yours, those in the know. And it was specifically directed at Adolf Hitler, who most certainly knew what that symbol meant as well.
Do you know this language?
Yes, well, I mean, nobody really purports to know the language. I've made an effort, and I've got an e-book available at my website that puts together keys to the language of the birds and the history of the bird language, who used it. Leonardo da Vinci used it. Mozart used it. Jules Verne made profuse use of it.
The magic flute is about the language of the birds, isn't it?
Yes,
it
is.
The Mozart opera, that incredible, wonderfully weird opera. And there's a fabulous movie about it by Ingmar Bergman called The Hour of the Wolf, which is a movie about the hidden secrets of the magic flute, and he did it as well, a movie of the magic flute, which was marvelous.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who's interested in it, really interested in the deeper meanings of this stuff, should take a look at The Hour of the Wolf. If you can stand it gets pretty scary.
Yeah, the bird language has been an incredible key for me in terms of apprehending these mysteries. And again, I don't purport to know everything about it. I've gained a little bit of wisdom with it. I'm certainly not a wealthy man. I don't purport to be a Solomon, but boy, you know, it is an invaluable key, and I encourage everyone to at least consider using it, because this is what they did. I mean, Jules Verne was one who said that, look, you know, pay close attention to names and place names that are used throughout history, because these words that are like fossils to a geologist, when you can dig down into words. Even Thomas Jefferson apprehended this, another druid. He said, look, I've got 6,400 books, and I'm paraphrasing him, but the best book that you can have as a research tool is a good dictionary, because the entire history of the human race is contained in a good dictionary.
In its words.
In its words, exactly.
In its words, yes.
Because those words will put you in resonance with ideas. They will help tune you to the Grail consciousness, to the Christ consciousness, or the thought sphere of all the sacred knowledge that is out there for everyone.
Well, we're coming up on the top of the hour. We will go into the phones after the top of the hour. For the whole fourth hour, you will be able to talk to William Henry and see what you can find out from this bearer of secret knowledge. His book, One Foot in Atlantis, Unforgettable. It's available 1-800-898-0284, or you can click through from whitleysworld.com and order it online tonight. One Foot in Atlantis, 1-800-898-0284. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland, and we'll be back.
WBMT. Rockies, dial 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, 1-800-618-8255. First-time callers may reach Whitley at area code 541-665-0520. And the wildcard line is open at area code 541-665-0521. This is Dreamland with Whitley Strieber on the Premier Radio Networks.
Okay, we are back. Jim Mars, a frequent guest on this program, is going to be at the Eclectic Viewpoint in Dallas, Texas on October the 22nd, talking about all manner of things, about his book, Rule by Secrecy, also about his upcoming fiction, which, like Majestic and like Ship of the Damned, is a book that attempts to use the fictional medium to tell more than you can say otherwise. It'll be held at the Richardson Civic Center in Dallas. To find out more about it, you can either go to their website, which is www.cheyennesdream.com. That's CHEYENNES-dream.com. That is named in memory of a dear friend of all of us, Cheyenne Turner, who created the Eclectic Viewpoint and died tragically young of breast cancer just a couple of years ago. A great, great lady. There is also a hotline recording, 214-706-3630. That's 214-706-3630. Well, something in William Henry's website has just blown me completely away. This is Whitley Strieber, it's Dreamland, and we're back with William Henry, author of One Foot in Atlantis. There are lots of calls and there are questions pouring in for William Henry on email as well. If you want to email a question, send it to whitley@strieber.com, and of course the lines are open. William Henry, I was looking through your website and I came across this, a picture of the pillar of or casket of Osiris at Abydos. Mm-hmm. And it says this: stories say this device had the ability to translate souls from one dimension to another. It could also drill holes in space, creating halls or doorways linking far-off regions of space to wells on Earth. Today, physicists call these wormholes or stargates. Now, what blew me away was there are some very strange paintings on the rafters at the temple at Abydos.
Mm-hmm.
A painting of seems to be a Sikorsky heavy lift helicopter, of a tank, a recognizable form of tank, and an airplane, a number of other things that are just really blow your mind strange. It got to the point where I asked some friends who were going to Egypt to look at this and to find out if this was a hoax or not. And they brought back photographs, and there was no question about it's no hoax. And now I find out that a device that could conceivably have sent somebody through time was housed there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time investigating that device. The actual illustration I believe you're referring to is a composite illustration that was put together by Dr. Richard H. Wilkinson, who's a top-notch Egyptologist from the University of Arizona.
That's of the casket of Osiris, but
yeah.
I'm referring to paintings.
Oh.
That are on the temple, that are on the rafters of
yes.
the temple of these modern devices. And,
right.
you know, it's possible, I suppose, at a stretch to say, well, it's not really a helicopter. It has to be something else, because obviously it's painted thousands of years ago. But, boy, I mean, you look at maybe one thing like that, you could say, but it's three or four things. And I've looked carefully at these pictures, and it's very, very hard to believe they aren't, that someone didn't see this.
Right. And I have to also mention that there's Henry Wallace wrote 117 letters to Nicholas Roerich during the time they were searching for Christ in Mongolia.
Mm-hmm.
One of them opens with the salutation, "Dear Guru, I see you holding the casket, the sacred, most precious casket, and I have thought of the admonition, we await the stone." Well, guess what the casket they're awaiting is? It's
what?
That casket of Osiris.
The casket of Osiris. Do you think it still exists in the physical world?
You hear stories that it was parked in another dimension. I also feel that ultimately part of the Templar treasure hoard included perhaps the blueprint or the instruction manual, the software for making that casket work, because it's a device that is alleged to be able to, as you said, drill holes in space. You're talking about a super hyperdimensional physics, and that, I believe, is in part what Nicholas Roerich was attempting to recover from Mongolia. Part of the evidence that they found something is circumstantial, but it's found on the back of everyone's $1 bill. We find there the Great Seal of the United States of America. And this was a symbol that was designed under the watchful eye of Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and John Adams. It was suppressed, literally put in a drawer for 100-some-odd years, and then in 1935, 1 year after the search for Christ in Mongolia, FDR is persuaded by Nicholas Roerich and Henry A. Wallace to put that symbol on the back of the dollar bill. And what it represents to the Masons is the missing capstone to the pyramid. And furthermore, it also represents the fulfillment of what the book of Matthew describes as the return of the missing cornerstone, who is Christ. And further, that symbol is not an original American symbol. It's Egyptian. It matches a logo for Osiris, which suggests that Osiris is all wrapped up in this, and they were looking for his casket in Mongolia, and they put his logo on the back of the $1 bill 1 year after they concluded the search for the casket of Osiris and also the Christ or Messiah. It's purely circumstantial, but it suggests a pattern is developing here. And further, that device could not only drill holes in space, but the software that went along with it gave one the ability to transmute the elements. And we're talking about the periodic table of elements here. And it's my speculation that some of these secrets were ultimately turned up at Los Alamos National Laboratories, and it was utilized in the development of the A-bomb and the H-bomb.
Of course. In other words, you're saying that the Grail secrets ended up at Los Alamos.
That's right. The Holy Grail is, of course, thought of as a simple carpenter's cup, but it's also a body of mystery teachings that were delivered by Jesus at the Last Supper and also at the crucifixion. And the elements, or the bread and wine of the Eucharist, are called the elements. And in all these years, we've been thinking that they're talking about some simple symbols, but perhaps Jesus was an alchemist, and he knew the secrets of transmuting not the elements of bread and wine, but the periodic table of elements. And what happens is at the crucifixion, Joseph of Arimathea holds up a cup that catches his transformed blood and sweat, his water, which also represents the secret teachings of the Grail. In the original French story that is told about that, the word they used was skill. He reaches up and he catches the skill of Christ. And we're thinking that this is some kind of a cup or some blood, but really what it is, Whitley, is its skill, its wisdom. And this is why the Templars represented the secrets of their secrets by a skull, which is also skill. It's not someone's cranium that the Templars possessed. They possessed the secret wisdom of Christ, the ability to transmute their own blood into Christ-like blood, which gave them access to this thought sphere I've been describing and the ultimate secrets of Christ. And this is what made them so dangerous to the religious and political authorities of their time.
You know, I wish you'd been able to hear the early part of this program when Linda Howe was describing what had happened to the blood of this bull that had been involved in one of these cattle mutilations. And you know, the Christ as as alchemist, as magician, is, you know, perfectly summed up in the marriage feast at Cana, of course, the transformation of water into wine, a chemical miracle, if there ever was one. The reason I bring the blood up again is because when we were talking, Linda and I were talking, we were speculating that we were seeing a shadow of a higher science in, among us when this extremely strange event took place. What happened was everything except the animal's hemoglobin was taken out of it, and the hemoglobin was left in a dried mass on its on the skin of the creature. And we don't even have a way to strip blood of its of the leukocytes and everything and just leave the hemoglobin in quite the way this was done. But what I'm getting at is this. It seemed to me that we were talking then about a shadow or an artifact of a higher science. Are you talking about a time when mankind lived by a higher science that we lost, and these men were desperately trying to put the pieces together before it was too late?
I think so. It has to do with a form of a higher light, wisdom, science, if you will. And this is kind of, I feel that that word sin that appears in the Bible has been misinterpreted. It's not that we're sinful because we're shameful, ugly, or born in guilt or anything like that. Sin is simply a Hebrew term that means miss the mark or miss the light. And so when we're born in sin, we're born without that light. And part of our earthly quest is to transform. We perform that miracle of Cana every single moment of our lives when we transmute the higher vibrational energies of the universe into our own blood. And the idea then is that within each and every one of us is a mystical apparatus for bringing this higher light, this higher science to the fore. And in so doing, we transform ourselves into flowers or flowers of this higher vibrational energy. We transform our world from a wasteland into a garden through this science and the apprehension of this higher light. And that seems to be a lot of what the rush was all about in the mystery schools, to regain these teachings, to reassemble the pieces so that we can reach up and bring this light into our world.
The a listener points out that we have inadvertently failed to put your website on your website link on our website. Normally, when a guest has a website on the Tonight Show section of Whitley's World, that website is available. It is not available tonight. It will be up tomorrow. The website for William Henry is www.williamhenry.net. That's William Henry. .net. Do you know what the symbol for the jet is, DJED?
Yes, of course.
What is that? A listener says, check the symbol of the jet. It's great that the Rainbow Project and Atlantis together. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, the jet or tet pillars were usually shown in pairs, varying heights. Sometimes when Isis, for example, the Egyptian goddess, it's an Egyptian symbol first and foremost, of course, and it represented a gateway. Strangely enough, though, they're virtually indistinguishable from a modern Van de Graaff generator, which was a device invented by an MIT physicist in the early 30s for atom-smashing experiments. And so what we're finding, what I've matched up, is the ancient science that coagulated around the TET, or JED, with nuclear particle physics, because ultimately the goddess for whom the Egyptians worship was named Nu, which is the root for nuclear, nurture, nurse, words such as that. And so it appears that they had this profound transmutational science that enabled them to accelerate their civilization. In fact, Egypt was originally called the land of Chem, or the land of transmutation.
That I did not know. A listener writes, I also saw a picture on the website that blew me away, on williamhenry.net, that blew me away. Under the article, Christ Cosmic Wormhole, it's a comparison to the face on the Shroud of Turin, revealing his identity. Could you talk about this a little bit?
I'd be happy to. That's
sure.
An incredible illustration. 1798, Napoleon.
And where exactly would we find it on the website?
It's in my article. I'm standing before the Church of Mary Magdalene at Rennes-le-Château. When you go to the website, if you click on that door, you'll open into some articles. And up at the top, there's one that's called Christ's Cosmic Wormhole.
Okay.
And in it, you'll find this illustration that was made in 1798, 100 years before the first official photograph of the Shrouded Turin was taken. It was made by a savant in Napoleon's army. Napoleon, of course, was a madman, just like Hitler, who is out to conquer the world by becoming a master in the occult arts. He took just a huge number of artists and savants with him into Egypt when he invaded Egypt and massively documented the temples, massively documented the street scenes, and so on and so forth. And among these incredible illustrations was one that shows the body of a serpent with the face of the Shroud of Turin on it. Now, my question is how is it possible that this person in 1798 could draw an astonishing likeness that was not revealed to the world for yet another 100 years, unless the original artist, way back when, had seen the man?
Yes.
Anyone that looks at this picture is going to appreciate that is an absolute ringer for the face that appears on the Shroud of Turin. Now, this is where it gets a little bit deep and a little bit strange. FDR, Henry Wallace.
I think it's gotten a little bit deep and a little bit strange a while ago, William, but go ahead.
Okay.
This is fabulous.
FDR, Nicholas Roach, and Henry Wallace go off to, are the three wise men going off to Mongolia in search of the reincarnated Christ or Messiah. I have these letters that suggest they found the casket. They're awaiting this casket, which, as you mentioned a moment ago, is capable of translating souls between dimensions. That casket is very frequently depicted with a squiggly little serpent guy housed within it.
Yes.
And my speculation is that the reason Christ is shown with the serpentine body is not because he has the body of a serpent, but because the Hebrew word for serpent and the Hebrew word for soul are interchangeable. They're both coming from the same phonetic root, Nahash and Neshama. Interchangeable phonetically, therefore, what we're looking at is not Jesus' face on a serpent, but Jesus' face on a soul that I speculate is housed in the casket of Osiris. Interdimensional device.
Whoa. Okay, I'm going to be levitating during the break. Thank you. That was just incredible. Breathtaking. And folks, I know there are a lot of calls backed up. We will get to everybody as soon as we return, and we will also get to as many of the email questions as we possibly can. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland, and we'll be right back.
West of the Rockies, 1-800-618-8255. First-time callers may use area code 541-665-0520. And the wildcard line is open at area code 541-665-0521. And now, here's Whitley.
Okay, we're back. We're going to be talking to William Henry and taking your calls in just a moment. I'm only going to talk for just a couple of seconds here to remind you of a couple of things. William Henry's website, by an oversight, is not up on our website. William Henry's website address is williamhenry.net. That's www.williamhenry.net.
It is a really information-packed website. Even more information-packed is his book, One Foot in Atlantis. It's available by going to whitleysworld.com. You can order tonight over the Internet, or you can call during business hours, 1-800-898-0284. That's our order line, 1-800-898-0284. One Foot in Atlantis is a book that is you're not so likely to find in your bookstore, and it is really, really worth having, as is obvious, I think, from listening to this fabulous information that William Henry has at his fingertips. He has just touched on so many remarkable things. I mean, this is a man with real inner knowledge and very much hidden knowledge. I wonder sometimes, I know that you know that I have a lot of people on this program that I know in fact have such knowledge, and they're very circumspect about where it came from. We'll see how he dances past his own origins in just a few seconds when we get back. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland, and we'll be right back. Whitley Strieber, it's Dreamland. We're back with William Henry. Your questions on the Internet, your phone calls, where the lines are loaded. I've got a new question coming in over the Internet for William Henry about every 5 seconds. And what this means is we're going to definitely have William on again very, very soon. This has been a whole lot of fun for me. I do not often hear a guest who knows more about this stuff than I do, frankly, and I don't want to be tooting my own horn, but this is my area of specialization, and William Henry knows a lot more than I do, and it's very, very exciting to be talking to him. Very proud to have him on my show. Annie, you've got a question.
William?
Yes.
Hi, this is Ann. How are
Hi,
you?
Ann.
Hi. Listen, you talk about FDR, you talk about Churchill. Are there any modern leaders who have any of this information? What do you think?
Oh, gosh, you would hope. I mean,
I don't see any signs of it, do you?
No, well, take a guy like Al Gore. I mean, his name, Al and Gore, are the two Islamic names for God. Oh. And his name is actually an anagram for Grael, which is the French word for grail. So if anyone would have a propensity for a grail
center, George Bush is the burning bush.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Well, yeah. I have to tell you, I don't mean to be facetious, but I cannot think of anyone I've ever seen or heard with less sort of, who seems to me to be less likely to possess occult knowledge than Al Gore. Maybe he's an empty grail.
Or George Bush is the tree of knowledge or the burning bush.
Right.
Okay. We've got loads of phone calls. We're going to go to the phones right away. Let's go to Gene in Illinois. Hi, Gene.
Hello?
Gene?
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for waiting across the break. I really apologize for not getting to it right away, but what's your question?
As I listen to you talk, you're not talking about Jesus Christ in that casket. You're talking about Cain. And Cain is a religious leader that loves money, sex, tobacco, booze, cheating, stealing, lying, and killing, and he does it through people.
Cain,
and,
C-A-I-N,
Jesus Christ is not the one that does the killing, like the religious killing that's going on right now in Israel. It's Cain and Lucifer. Religion is the biggest deceiver and the biggest moneymaker to ever cross the board, and we got to understand that. I start praying for the devil that Jesus Christ can help him through our prayers to pull us out of the trouble we're in.
Okay, that's an interesting thought. Do you have any thoughts about Cain, William?
Cain, of course, is the son of Adam who murdered his brother Abel.
Right.
He was a smith. His name means smith. And there's some authors, Sir Lawrence Gardner is one, Zechariah Sitchin is another, that upholds Cain as the first alchemist, the first purveyor of smithcraft on Earth. A tremendously secretive figure. I mean, I try to stay away from some of the alarming epitaphs that are put onto some of these figures because anything that I just don't really go along with this born in sin story and some of those things, because I think ultimately what we're looking for here is knowledge, and if we're always giving away our power to other authorities, then we're never going to seek that knowledge that some of these figures possess.
Okay, let's keep going. Let's go to Carden in Fort Wayne. Hi, Carden.
Yes, gentlemen.
Yes, sir. We sure can.
Okay. This guy is right down the line. I'm one of the indigo children that you talk about, and I'm not being facetious. But this knowledge is old hat for me. My dad was a high-level Knights Templar, and before he died, there were some things he taught me. You know, in the Revelation where God says, I am one God in three forms, having seven spirits, that's 137. Now, that's his number. Now, you know that the word Jehovah is one word, three syllables, seven letters, and Jesus' name was Yeshua, which is one word, three syllables, seven letters, on earth as it is in heaven. The word Calvary, Trinity, Apostle, Lucifer, Genesis, Pyramid, and the word Messiah is one word, three syllables, seven letters. The Star of David is the 137 symbol because our clock, our color wheel, our 12 scales of music are based on it, and I am a piano tuner, and that's how I know for sure. And you see, Christ was nothing except for what he represented, and he said, my people perish for lack of knowledge. So Henry, stay online, stay on that quest, and you'll what I know is just the tip of the iceberg of what I have time to tell you right now.
It was too bad you weren't alive when Wolfgang Pauli was alive. He won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1945 for his early atomic work.
Yeah.
And he was haunted by that number 137. He could never figure out what it meant.
Well, I know what it means.
Really?
Yeah. And in fact, on his deathbed, I mean, his whole life, he said, what is 137? What is the business about that?
Wait a minute, William.
It's a pure number.
I know, but why did he find what made that number so haunting to him?
Well, he could never figure out why it was such a pure number.
What makes it a pure number?
The mathematics of it. I'm at a loss right now to give you the exact specifics of it because it's pretty complicated math, but that's the number that haunted him his whole life. And even when he went to his deathbed, the number of the hospital room that he died in was 137. And the caller is exactly right. In the Hebrew numerological system, Christ adds up to 137.
Gosh, we have a lot of interesting listeners.
Yeah.
The caller is gone now, but my, it's like suddenly a window opens onto an incredible secret. He says, I'm a piano tuner. My father was a Templar. And then he proceeds to come up with a really fascinating piece of secret knowledge that even haunted a great physicist like Pauli. And, okay, well, let's just keep going. Who knows what else we're going to come up with tonight. Let's go to Phil in Fresno. Hi, Phil.
Yeah, hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Okay. Pleasure to talk with you, Whitley. I wish you'd open the phones up a little bit sooner. I've been wanting to call you for months. I've had an encounter myself. Maybe we can talk about that sometime.
Okay.
Mr. Henry, I was rather... we don't get the last hour of Dreamland here, so I'm just calling.
Oh, that's okay.
But I was rather fascinated with your talk about the language of the birds. I had a rather remarkable vision here about a month ago. Just as I was waking up, I was diving towards a beach. I could see the waves, the color of the water, the sand, and there was no fear whatsoever, but it was such a stark vision that it woke me up, and the only conclusion I could come to was that I was seeing it from a bird's point of view. It was very real. And language, I don't know about birds, seem to talk to me. My question is this. It seems that a thread that runs through kind of all of this is a human desire for power. And much of it seems to center around the wisdom of Solomon. Do you believe that the lesson, as I do, that the lesson that we really have to learn is that we do have, in fact, no preeminence over the so-called beasts?
Well, yeah, that's a very poetic way of saying it. You know, certainly that we have this kinship to all of creation, that we're all one. And that certainly is one of the foremost lessons of the language of the birds. Adam was supposed to have been taught this language by God himself. And with this language, Adam walked around the Garden of Eden, and he named all the objects. And by so naming them, he was able to put himself in resonance with those objects, including all of nature. And so that's also why the language of the birds, that's why the alchemists called it the green language, because it is the language of nature. It's the language that puts you in harmony with all of creation.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Maybe the only way that we can find our way back to some state of grace here is to try and restore some of the damage we've done, like to the ozone. I mean, as I know it's a very mundane thing, but in all this seeking for the Holy Grail and all this power and enhancement and higher levels of consciousness and so on, maybe it's just something as simple as trying to do something to fix the damage we've done.
Well, it's not just about power, though. I have to take issue with that. It's about bringing in a new light. I mean, the Egyptians described this scarab beetle pushing along this dung ball, and they said at the greatest moment of darkness, that's also the moment of your greatest possibility, for that's when the new light can come in. And I wonder, people don't like it when I talk about the chemtrails as having some form of any possible positive spin on them, but going back to that notion that Egypt was called the land of chem, maybe we're turning our planet into a new land of chem, and these chemtrails have some role to play in the transmutation of our planet, just preparatory towards bringing in this new higher dimensional light.
Well, I'm going to bring that up next week with Greg Avery and Bill Thomas and see how they react to that. Okay, let's keep going. Let's go to Gregory in Maryland. Hi, Gregory.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Is this Whitley?
It sure is.
I can't believe I'm talking to you.
Well, you sure are.
I'm probably never going to get through again, so let me just want to make a comment, is that you're on the brink of a great understanding, but it's not an external science. It's an internal science.
You know, Gregory, there's going to come a day in this radio program when you will know why I am so totally amazed by what you just said.
Listen.
There is a hidden reason for this, and it will come out probably in the next month or so.
Yes,
go
I
ahead.
I want to reveal something to you. The internal science is the snake represents an internal energy. By chanting certain sounds based upon vowels, you can awaken a certain energy in the body that transforms your consciousness, that brings a whole evolutionary change. I've experienced it myself, and what has happened is, I don't have a long time here, but the seminal fluid reverses itself and flows upward through the spine, and when it does, it looks just like a snake twirling about, almost like a DNA sequence. And when it hits the brain, it's like a fireworks go off in your mind, and a vortex opens in the forehead. And this vortex allows you to pierce dimensions, the holes in space you're talking about. Also, you will receive visions of the future. Perhaps back then, they saw visions of the future of helicopters or future events. And you need to do a program. The only word I can use that you can have reference is Kundalini. Kundalini. And you will find... Can you still hear me?
Oh, sure. We can hear you.
You will find these reference points down through history. This is the secret knowledge. And what I'm saying is that if you look at the American Indian headdress, you'll see the feathers and the, say, a triangle in the middle of the forehead. In Hindu, you will find the dot in the middle of the forehead. In the Egyptian symbols, you see the snake coming out of the forehead. Well, that's exactly what the energy looks like. I'll call it energy. When it hits the brain area, it spins something in the pineal gland area in the center of the brain. And you see it as light. You actually experience a physical sensation of light. Maybe it's electrical, chemical. But it is a transmutation, basically, of the reproductive fluids. And it was a shock to me when it happened. And I found that the reproductive centers have a dual function. And they actually change something in the brain structure that actually stays with you. And when I go to sleep at night, I hear a humming in my ears, and there is a light. I don't sleep in the dark anymore. I have light around my forehead. This could be why the saints had pictures of halos around them. There's many symbols, and what you're seeing on these sarcophagus or these covers was symbols for the ancient knowledge. And I believe that ancient knowledge was left, and only the symbols are really remaining. But anybody who's really experienced what I've experienced will make connections with these symbols just by looking upon them.
Yeah, I teach a workshop on that. In fact, you'll want to go to my website and download my book, God Making, How Ancient Myths of DNA Reveal the Miracle Healing Power of Our Mystic Anatomy, because I go into 300 pages of detail about our mystic anatomy and exactly the process the caller just described. We all have an Ark of the Covenant within us. We all have a Djed pillar within us. We all have a Jacob's ladder within us. It's in our mystic anatomy. It's our body system. It's our birthright, our gift from God. Our body is literally a resurrection machine for the soul to return to God. And what the caller describes is absolutely right on, in my
opinion. This is somebody who knew what he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I'm well aware of that. You know, folks, number of adepts have called up tonight who had really profound knowledge, and if I were you, I would get a copy of this tape or of this show, or be sure and pull it off the archives, because this information was flying past very quickly, as it always does when people like that are around. But it's valuable, and you can take it bit by bit, and you can learn a lot from this. Okay, let's go to our next call. Let's go to Lily in Santa Barbara. We have just a tiny bit of time, Lily, so let's be real quick. You got a question?
Yes, I do. I'm wondering if you are intimating that Jesus and Osiris are the same soul, and as well Mary Magdalene and Isis are the same soul, and that we are expecting these two souls to return.
What an interesting question. Thank you, Lily. Okay, William, how do you react?
That's a very good possibility.
I think it's a fabulous question, I have to tell you.
Yeah, there's a whole body of research out there that addresses this, the similarities, the striking, undeniable relationships between the teachings of Jesus and Osiris. There's also those that say actually John the Baptist was that figure. Osiris was portrayed in the Egyptian tradition as a being that came from the stars, taught the art of gardening, and sought to conquer the world through music, through tones, through frequency, vibration. And lo and behold, in the book of John, after the resurrection, Jesus appears to Mary Magdalene as the gardener. She mistakes him for somebody else, but he corrects her and identifies himself as the gardener, which certainly suggests that he's intimating that he is the returning Osiris.
Well, on that note, William, we are coming to the end of this week's Dreamland. To get one foot in Atlantis, and do not miss this, 1-800-898-0284, or click through from whitleysworld.com. William, thank you. It has been a truly extraordinary journey tonight.
Oh, and absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you, Whitley, so much.
We will have you back very soon, for sure. Our engineer in San Antonio is Don Cooper. At Premier, it is Mike Kincaid. Our producer is Ann Strieber. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland, and we'll talk at you next week.
To purchase cassette copies of this program, dial 1-800-917-4278.